أعوذ بالله من الشيطان الرجيم. بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم. الحمد لله رب العالمين وبه نستعين، إنه خير ناصر ومعين. ولا حول ولا قوة إلا بالله العلي العظيم. ثم الصلاة والسلام على أشرف الأنبياء والمرسلين وخاتم النبيين وسيد المرسلين، أبي القاسم محمد. وعلى آل بيته الطيبين الطاهرين المعصومين المظلومين، لا سيما بقية الله في الأرضين. السلام على الحسين وعلى علي بن الحسين وعلى أولاد الحسين وعلى أصحاب الحسين. My respected elders, brothers and sisters in Islam and Iman, Salamun alaykum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh. Alhamdulillah for the opportunity to gather here tonight as part of the Ashra of Zainabiyah. I was speaking to somebody earlier today, one of the elders of the community, who was informing me that this Ashra of Zainabiyah is something that wasn't always there. It's something that developed over time, and over time it came to be what it is that we know it to be now. And these types of sunan and these types of traditions, which are sunnatun hasana, good traditions, need to be embraced, need to be adopted, need to be appreciated as well too. It's because of the barakah of that one lady and her remembrance that we come together, that we greet one another, we ask about each other, we further and strengthen our brotherhood and sisterhood, and we remind ourselves of our responsibilities towards Allah and the Ahlul Bayt alayhim wassalam. And hope that inshallah we can take the most of this opportunity and appreciate the blessings that we have. The third tradition that we covered in the series of traditions that we're looking at that have to do with practical advice of living in the West, living in an environment in which we are minorities being Muslims, was the one that we covered yesterday. It's reported from Imam As-Sadiq alayhi salam. Who said, one of you may say that he is gharib, he is alone, a stranger away from his hometown. Yet the true gharib is the one who is present and who lives in the land of shirk. Last night we covered one take on this tradition. It's a very important lesson that we took, which we went and examined the relationship between being in a society of shirk, being in a society which worships other than God, and how that can contribute towards one feeling loneliness. And we explain how one of the aspects of such a society is that it worships the material, it worships possessions. There's a hunger and thirst for wanting to make it big for the sake of wanting to make it big. Just as a quick summary, because it's important for us to continue off as we didn't have time to finish it last night. We talked about how in the modern world we have problems and diseases that were not known before. Among them are diseases having to do with the spirit and the soul. And even though it's important for us to go to medical experts when we have medical problems, we should understand that there are a whole class of diseases that have to do with the soul and the spirit. sometimes an excessive feeling of loneliness, of not knowing one's place in this world, of depression and anxiety can stem from a problem which is a spiritual problem, a disconnect from God. Because after all, somebody who tries to approach the material world and say that this is what my goal in life is, this is what's created for me, this is what I've been created for, they'll find that there's a complete and utter mismatch. For example, if I take this tablet right here, this is, I like to use this example because it's right in front of me. This is an iPad. If I try to run the Android operating system on it, it's not going to work. There's a mismatch. This was created for something, and Android was created for something else. If I myself make it my goal to be after this world, then I become one who is like how Imam Al-Kadhim describes, alayhi salam, salawat ala Muhammad. He says that somebody who is going after the dunya, okay, and as we explained, dunya in the bad meaning of it, the dunya which is haram, that dunya which is to be avoided, it's like somebody who is thirsty, who is trying to drink from the water of the ocean. You've heard this example before. It's a beautiful example. Somebody who is thirsty needs their thirst to be quenched, just like we have a need to be fulfilled. But when they go to the salt water in the ocean to quench their thirst, however much they drink, because of the presence of salt in that water, it's only going to make them more thirsty. Similarly, if we make our goal be the material world, then as we go after it, we hunger after it, we want more and more and more, we're not going to be satiated. We're not going to find that itminan that Allah talks about in the Quran. And He says, أَلَا بِذِكْرِ اللَّهِ تَطْمَئِنُّ الْقُلُوبِ. If you have a need for comfort, you have a need for solace, but that solace cannot be found solely by focusing on the material world. Now, we also explained how the Islamic solution is not one of abandoning and of avoiding, but rather of interacting in an intelligent manner. And we talked about some very practical and simple but effective guidelines that we can put into practice when interacting with the dunya, when making decisions about how to interact with the world around us. There's a second interpretation of this hadith. And one thing I want to mention here is that our hadith are not to be taken lightly and simply. We need to examine them and study them. And in fact, our experts spend years and years learning the tools and sciences by which they can analyze and interpret hadith. Why? Because the Ahlul Bayt themselves told us to do this. In one hadith, the Imam Alayhi Salaam tells us, hadithun tadri khayrun min alfin tarwih. Meaning what? Meaning that if you were to understand fully one of our traditions, it's better than your narrating 1,000 traditions. Meaning that if you were to just memorize 1,000 traditions and just say, okay, this is what the Imam Sadiq said, this is what Imam Bakr says, etc., etc., and you didn't understand the depth of it, that wouldn't be amount to much. But rather, what's value is when we take a tradition and we analyze and understand the depth of it. And that's something that distinguishes us, our school of thought, the Shia school of thought, when it comes to our approach to the hadith. The second meaning of this tradition is it's a meaning that gives us a lot of hope. And it's the following. Imam Sadiq alayhi salam is saying that the one who is living in the land of shirk is the one who is truly gharib. He's truly alone. Imam Sadiq alayhi salam in this interpretation is praising and is admiring the one who is alone. And he's stating a matter of fact, which is that for a believer who is living in the land of shirk, who is living in a society which is predominantly non-Muslim, that believer is going to be alone. He is going to be different. He is going to be rare. He is going to be isolated to a certain extent. And that's something which is praiseworthy. Now, I know that this might cause some alarm bells to ring, because you can interpret what I just said in a negative way, which is to say that, okay, Imam alayhi salam is saying that if we come into society, we have to be aloof from everyone. So I want to quickly and very emphatically state that that's not what is meant here. Let's just look at our situation, brothers and sisters. Here we are, we're practicing, inshallah, practicing believers. And we're in a society where people have different values and different norms. And we've talked a lot about how our responsibility isn't to stay away, but we want to be part of the society, we have to be part of it. But there are going to be places where we do things which are different. For example, the way that we dress, especially our sisters, it's going to be different than the way the typical person dresses in the society. The way that we conduct ourselves, there's an office party going on. Let's say it's Christmas time, and a lot of you who are working are aware of this, that towards this time it's all about pubs and parties and these types of things. A practicing believer is going to be isolated in this type of situation. He's going to be alone. He's going to be separate from the rest of the people. School. There's a class formal, a prom. The practicing believer is going to keep him or herself away from this type of thing. And there's so many other examples where because of our faith and because of our practice, we're going to do things which are different than the others, and sometimes we'll be standing alone. On the other hand, we have a phenomenon called Islamophobia, where there are certain groups of people who wish to stir up fear and hate, and sometimes we're the subject of ridicule and hate as well too. Now in all these circumstances, we have to ask ourselves, okay, here I am. I am doing something which is contrary to the current. I'm swimming upstream. I'm doing something which is causing me to stick out like a sore thumb in some respect. What is the position of Islam on that? What is it that my Imam is thinking about me in this situation right here? And Imam Sadiq alayhi salam gives us a clue. What does he say? He says that إِنَّمَا الْغَرِيب, the true person who is alone is the one who is present in the land of shirk. The Imam alayhi salam is aware of our situation. He's aware of the fact that we're alone. And that gives us a lot of hope that the Imam is there for us. The Imam knows about our situation. Again, the idea here isn't that a believer is supposed to cut away from the society. Look at this tradition, a very beautiful tradition from Imam Bakr alayhi salam. He is speaking to one of his companions named Kamil At-Tammar. Imam alayhi salam, if you look at the traditions of the Ahlul Bayt, sometimes they would quiz their close companions. They want to test them. He asks him, he says that there's a verse in the Quran which says, قَدْ أَفْلَحَ الْمُؤْمِنُونَ. Indeed, the believers are those who are successful. He asks him, do you know who these people are? What are their characteristics? The Imam alayhi salam wants to know what he thinks about this. Kamil is smart. He says that, why don't you tell me? You're a'lam. You know better than I do. The Imam alayhi salam goes on to explain. He says that, قَدْ أَفْلَحَ الْمُؤْمِنُونَ. Who are they? They are the ones who are al-musallimun. They are the ones who submit. إِنَّ الْمُسَلِّمِينَ هُمَا النُّجَبَاءَ فَالْمُؤْمِنُ غَرِيبٌ فَطُوبَى لِلْغُرَبَاءَ. He's saying that the mu'min, those who are truly mu'min, who are going to succeed, they are going to have, essentially, there's no way that somebody can be a mu'min and can be just like everyone else out there. They have to be unique. They have to be distinct. And that's something which is okay. Why? Because قَدْ أَفْلَحَ الْمُؤْمِنُونَ. That's going to result in success. That's what God wants from us. Imam Ali alayhi salam, he's describing the qualities and the traits of the true believers. What does he say? He says that صاحب الدنيا بأبدان أرواحها معلقة بالمحل الأعلى. It's not the case that they have cut themselves away from the society. They're there. They show themselves where they need to show themselves. They're going to work. They're going to school. They're members of the society. However, there's something different about them. There's a spiritual dimension to them. You see their bodies just like everyone else's body, but there's a spiritual dimension. What does he say? He says that their bodies are accompanying everyone else's bodies, but their souls are tied to something which is higher, to the highest of places. This is the way a believer is envisioned in the eyes of the Ahlul Bayt alayhi wasalam. In the words of our beloved Prophet, he says that a believer needs to perform a hijrah, an emigration. What kind of emigration? He says that the true emigrant, the true muhajir, isn't somebody who leaves the society. No. It's man hajara sayyi'at wa taraka ma harum Allah. It's the one who leaves aside those deeds which God has said are evil and which God has prohibited. This is a type of behavior that the Ahlul Bayt are looking from us and they're expecting from us, and even though it may entail difficulty, it's something that they are aware of and they're proud of us in this regard as well too. This is what we understand from the tradition. Peace be salawat on Muhammad wa ala Muhammad. Now, brothers and sisters, what I'd like to do now is to step back a little bit, and before we leave this very important concept of loneliness, there's a very necessary comparison that I feel we need to perform right here. Because after all, we're living in this society right here, and definitely it's the case that we find people are lacking when it comes to the feeling of belonging. And they're lacking when it comes to the feeling of just being happy. And what I'd like to discuss for the remainder of this speech is that part of this has to do with the nature of social relationships in the society we live in. And I want to offer a critique about this. Now, some of you may find it difficult to swallow when we critique the society around us. Because when we look at it, we see things which are praiseworthy. We see things like accomplishments. We see things like technology. In some respects, we see justice. We see honor. We see truthfulness. And we say that we've gotten so much out of being here that we wouldn't have gotten had we not come here. So do we have a right to criticize it? On the other hand, some people say that, okay, when we go to, if you're saying that Islam has a better solution, whenever we look at Muslims, right, we say that we don't see anything that's admirable among them. Right, when we go to Muslim countries, we see backwardness, we see intolerance, we see just all the different adjectives you can come up with to describe a community that's not to be admired. So on one hand, we find values that are admirable in our society. On the other hand, we don't find things to admire among the Muslims. So how can we offer a critique of that? What I'd like to say here is that sometimes we need to be, and when we're comparing and contrasting, we have to understand that we're not looking at things equally. We're not comparing apples to apples. We're comparing apples to oranges. What I mean by this is that when we look at this society and we see the positive aspects of it, and we compare them to another society, we have to ask, are we comparing them at the same level? Because oftentimes we might find that things are good in a society, but they come at an expense, and that expense isn't felt here, it's felt elsewhere. For example, if it's the case that there is oppression taking place outside, for example, back in the old days, colonization, and because of that, people are happy inside, right? Then is it fair to say that, oh, everyone's happy here, there's so much justice, there's so much happiness, while oppression is taking place outside? That's point number one. I just want you to ponder upon that point. Point number two is that we are never supposed to judge Islam by Muslims, by the general public of Muslims. Because after all, Islam is something which came, which was meant to be developed and practiced until that final just society is created with the coming of the Imam of our time. Until then, we're developing, we're growing. But we're never supposed to assume that we've already reached there. No, we have our examples who are the Ahlul Bayt alayhim wassalam. If we want to compare and look at what Islam is supposed to be, those are the people we have to look at, not the general Muslim. There was a man named Zuhri, who was a companion of Imam Sadiq alayhi salam, Imam Zainul Abidin alayhi salam. And one day he goes to Hajj and he's there with his Imam. And the Imam wishes to teach him a lesson. He says that, Zuhri, how many pilgrims do you see there performing the Hajj? And he goes and he says, he counts them, he sees that there's thousands and thousands of pilgrims who are there. Then the Imam alayhi salam says, come close to me. He comes close and he passes his hand over his face. And suddenly he sees things in a different perspective. Now he tells, the Imam commands him, he says, now look and see what you, and tell me what you see. Zuhri looks again, and now he sees a completely different sight. He tells the Imam that, oh Imam, before I was seeing all these human beings, but now all I see are monkeys. And only rarely do I see a human being. In the hadith it says, one out of every roughly 10,000 people do I see a human being. The Imam alayhi salam says, come again, come close to me. He passes his hand over his face once again, and his normal vision is restored to him. The Imam alayhi salam makes a comment there. He says, مَا أَكْثَرَ الْبَجِيجِ وَأَقَلَّ الْحَجِيجِ. He says that, you see, there's so many people who are making wailing noises. But how few hujjaj actually there are. How many few people are actually performing the hajj. How many of them are truly there for the right reason and truly human beings? Now, brothers and sisters, let's not take this in a negative way, a pessimistic way. Remember, this is the time soon after Karbala, right? The amount of iman that was present in the society at that time was very little. There were very few people who truly had understood Islam at that time. But it just shows us that we're never supposed to judge Islam by the Muslims. We're supposed to judge it by the Ahlul Bayt alayhi Muslim and by the ideals and teachings of Islam. I want to give you some examples which will show how Islam offers a superior alternative to the social culture that we find the norm in any Western society. Let me give you some examples. Okay, first of all, in a typical material perspective on things, if I don't see you as essential to my material accomplishments, then I'm going to ignore you. I'm not going to pay any attention to you. Okay, example, go in the subway, right, and see how many people care about you. How many people ask about you. Or how many people are just sitting there doing their own thing and don't have really a care over what's going around them. Somebody was telling me that you can be in riding the same train as somebody else for 20 years and not know that they're actually your neighbor. Because that's the type of society that we live in. Yeah, if it's the case that somebody's really in trouble, then as part of being a good Samaritan, somebody might come and step up and help out. But for the most part, people are doing their own thing unless somehow you are involved with my material goals and accomplishments. Now, that type of attitude is something that we find foreign to the teachings of Islam. And this is something, brothers and sisters, which I really have to offer with all earnestness, because sometimes we find that these same types of ethics creep into our own societies and our own communities. What I mean by this is that how is it that we are treated when we go to our own centers and our own communities versus the way that Islam has painted for us as an ideal? Let me give you an example. What we're told in a tradition from Imam Sadiq, he says that the Prophet said that these things are considered acts of dhulm, acts of oppression. Number one is that if somebody is to be in the company of somebody else, these are among believers, and they don't ask them their name and their name of their family, that's considered an act of oppression. Number two, if somebody invites somebody else for a meal and that person doesn't accept, or they accept and they go back on their promise, this is also an act of injustice according to the teachings of Islam. Okay, another thing, right? We're told that again from Imam Sadiq, he says that if somebody were to smile at the face of his fellow mu'min, then that would be counted as a hasana, an act of worship for him. Now, these are things that we learned when we were 5 years old in madrasa, the importance of smiling, the importance of being friendly. But we have to ask ourselves, are these things which we find normal in our communities? One brother was telling me that he was so concerned about this issue. This was in a different community. He was so concerned about this issue, he was worried about it. He was saying that, okay, in my center, I know that there will be people who come in who are, for example, non-Muslims curious about Islam. Or they are people who are other, who have an ethnicity other than the dominant ethnicity in my community. But I know my people, and I know they're not friendly to these people. So what did I do? I set up a special welcoming committee, which will go and if anybody new comes in, they'll go and greet them. And he says, I kept that up, and it was going strong, and it was working out, and we had all these great things going on, until, he said, the new committee came in, and then the whole thing got nixed. Okay? Now the question I ask is this, is that that's a great idea, but is that the solution to the problem? Or is it the case that we as a community need to go back to our roots and understand how is it that we're supposed to be interacting with each other? We're told in tradition that, this is from Imam Radha alayhi salam, he says that whenever you interact with somebody, a mu'min, make sure to do so in the most beautiful way possible, whether that person be old or they be young. Is that the type of communities that we have, where we have that sort of interaction? And so on, and so on, and so on, we find that the ideal that's being painted is different than the ideal we find. Where is the humanity? Where is that cheerfulness? Where is that friendliness? We find it lacking in the society outside of us, and sometimes even in our own centers as well. Sallu ala Muhammad wa ali Muhammad. Brothers and sisters, when our maraji, our current maraji, have written on the topic of what we need to do living in ghurba, living away from the Muslim lands, one of the things they highly emphasize is this very point of making sure that we have strong social circles. They tell us that on one hand, we should have our own circles. And on the other hand, we should be part of the larger community as well too. They emphasize things like participating in Salatul Jama'ah. Brothers and sisters, we're supposed to be frequently having gatherings together, and we're supposed to be frequently praying together as well too. Look at one of the philosophies of Salatul Jama'ah, again from our Prophet. He says that when you go for Salatul Jama'ah, keep your lines straight. Why? Is it just because? Is it just like an artistic sort of thing so that it looks nice? No. Keep your lines straight. There's a philosophy behind this so that your hearts can be kept aligned as well. إِسْتَوُوا تَسْتَوِي قُلُوبُكُمْ وَتَمَاسَوْا وَتَرَاحَمُوا. Like, let your bodies touch each other in Salatul Jama'ah. Don't be so unfriendly to me. Don't be so cold. Come and stand next to me. Why? So that your hearts can find a harmony between each other. And you can have mercy and love between one another as well too. This is the type of ideals that are being painted by the Prophet when it comes to our social gatherings. Sallu ala Muhammad wa ala Muhammad. Another thing that you find in the culture around us is this idea that if things get busy for me, right? Let's say somebody has a special project at work and they have to work overtime. Or if I just get upset with the situation, you know, something happens, bad politics, right? There's an argument and, you know, I don't like the way things turned out. Then I'm just going to disappear. I won't show up for like, you know, a couple of Thursdays or maybe a couple of months, you know, or maybe even a couple of years sometimes. And this happens sometimes. We know about these. We hear about stories. Somebody feels bad about a comment that was made to her, and as a result, she stops going to the center completely from then on. Right? This is a typical materialistic perspective towards the idea that it's up to me to decide my own participation in the community. No, it's not up to you. There are rights that we have to uphold to others. Look at what the tradition we have from our Prophet. It says the following, that al-mu'min الذي يخالط الناس ويصبر على أذاهم, the believer who mixes with the people and is patient over the troubles that he faces when dealing with them, that mu'min will be given a greater reward than the mu'min who doesn't mix with others and has no patience for the troubles that they have to face. And this is one of a number of traditions which we have regarding this. Yes, it's difficult sometimes to come and there's parking issues and there's, you know, somebody's socks are smelly and I don't know what other problems that we have. We have arguments, we have this thing, that thing. But at the end of the day, this is what we're supposed to do. This is part of our responsibility of coming, especially when we're in these lands where there's so much loneliness out there. We're setting ourselves up for our own destruction by pulling away. Sometimes people say that, okay, fine, I'm not happy with the people who are going to be there for whatever reason, so I'm just going to do everything online. Because today, in today's world, you know, alhamdulillah, we have that technology. Now, I'm not one to say that we shouldn't do stuff online. No, there's value for that. There's a benefit in doing so. But brothers and sisters, it's not supposed to be an alternative. It's not the case that we can... Have you ever tried to do Salatul Jama'ah through the live stream? Like, does it work that way? Right? There's more than just the words that are said after all. Right? We have in hadith, خُذُ الْعِلْمَ مِنْ أَفْوَاهِ الرِّجَالِ, take knowledge from the mouths of the teachers. And some of the ulama have interpreted that, they've said that one of the aspects of that is being in their presence. Right? This is something which is very important. Just recently, one of my colleagues was reporting, he was saying that during the month of Muharram, some of the revert Muslims started to come back to the center. Because one of the first groups that's quick to leave the centers is our fellow brothers and sisters who have reverted to Islam. Why? Because they find a lot of frustration when it comes to the attitude of others towards them. And this is an issue which needs to be addressed, and there's a lot of points that we can make regarding that, but that's not the focus of my attention right now. Anyhow, they started coming back in Muharram, and one of them made this comment. He said that, you know what, when we stop attending the center, we get into the habit of not coming. And once you get in the habit of doing something, it's very hard to break that habit as well too. And it's not only we who suffer, our children suffer as well, brothers and sisters. Yes, it might break the routine to come to the center. Yes, it might mean that that perfect schedule, which includes that bedtime that I've scheduled in, has to be broken one day a week or one day once in a while. But it's okay. Okay, it's okay. It's not, some things are worth breaking the schedule for. There's so much blessings that can be gotten by being together and by interacting with one another. Sallu ala Muhammad wa ala Muhammad. There's so many aspects, brothers and sisters, that we can look at and compare and contrast. I know the time is running. I just want to give a couple of more examples just to make sure that the point is made very, very, inshallah, emphatically. In this society, I can say things like, for example, that I don't want to impose on other people. Right? You hear about this. I don't want to impose. Right? People are busy. They have their own lives. You know, I have my own things going on as well too. We're just going to do our own thing. It's the weekend, right? We could go and, you know, visit our this person, go that, but we have our own thing to do. And after all, we're busy. We have our own things. Maybe I can, you know, catch up some extra work as well too in the weekend, that type of thing, right? Is this what Islam has to offer us? Is this what Islam guides us towards? Not at all. We have so much recommendation for visiting each other. So much recommendation. The traditions are just phenomenal regarding this. Let me just quote you one of them. Imam alayhi salam says that whoever visits his brother for the sake of God, whether he be sick or whether he be healthy as well too, sometimes you knock on the door, somebody says, is there a problem? Why did you come? Right? No. Whether they're sick or whether they're healthy. لَا يَأَتِيهِ خِذَالًا وَلَا إِسْتِبْدَالًا. It's not about trying to, there's no ulterior motive behind them visiting. Nor is it the case that they're trying to do a tit-for-tat thing. That because you came to visit me, therefore I'm going to come visit you. No. Purely for the sake of Allah, I'm going to knock on your door. Yes, I can go and knock on somebody's door without pre-announcing as well too. And it's not a bad thing. What's going to happen as a result of that? وَكَّلَ اللَّهُ بِهِ سَبْعِينَ أَلْفَ مَلَكٍ Allah will appoint 70,000 angels for that mu'min, and they will be praying for him. إِن طِبْتَ وَطَابَتْ لَكَ الْجَنَّةِ You are destined for paradise. فَأَنْتُمْ زُوَارُ اللَّهِ You think that you're visiting the mu'min, but actually you're visiting Allah. Okay, I mean, we can't even fathom the extent of reward, but this is the importance of having these type of social relationships. Another thing in the society, okay, this is an example from that applies to many different things, including a community, including marriage as well too, which is that if I get upset at you, then I'm going to make it up. I have to take revenge on you as well too. I have to respond fire with fire. Okay, now we have examples, a famous story, you've heard this before since you were a child, but it's such a beautiful example. Somebody saw this one man walking in the streets of Kufa, and he was a very tall, noble man. This was a merchant, right? He sees him and he doesn't like his looks, so he makes fun of him, he calls him a name, he jeers, taunts him. That man goes walking and he walks into the masjid. This merchant is sitting here. His friend tells him, do you know who you just insulted right now? He says, no. He says, you just insulted Malik Ashtar. Right? He goes, Malik Ashtar. Malik Ashtar was famous, right? I mean, he was like, you know, he was the man, right? He was the warrior, he was a champion. So he goes and he runs into the masjid after him. He says that, oh Malik, what did I just do? You know, he might order me, because he knows he has a special relationship with the Khalifa, Imam Ali alayhi salam. I'm going to be punished. He says, he goes into the masjid, he sees that he's praying. And he waits until Malik finishes salat. And he says that, look, I'm so sorry, he's crying, I apologize for what I did, I offended you, I didn't mean to do so. What does Malik Ashtar say? He says that, by Allah, I came to the masjid for your sake. I understood that you were misguided and unwise, and I felt sad for you, so I came here to pray for you and to pray that Allah guides you to the right path. The response that we have in Islam for a mu'min offending another mu'min is to pray for them, to want their good for them. And if we apply this to marriages, brothers and sisters, so many things can change. The entire philosophy of marriage can change. For marriage isn't about my trying to milk my partner for the most that I can get out of him or her. Rather, it's trying to see that I am responsible for trying to help him or her to get to heaven, to find the path to Allah, and I'll do whatever I can, whatever it takes. The society out there doesn't have something called dua. I have dua. Right? When you depart from one another and we ask each other to pray for each other, why is that? Is it just a formality? It's a reality. Try this once. Try to pray for somebody that you have bad feelings towards, a mu'min, and see what happens. See the blessings that will happen in your life. Sallu ala Muhammad wa ali Muhammad. The examples are many, but time is running. I want to conclude by just emphasizing one point, which is that this is when our ulama, our maraji, have written on this topic. I said this earlier, but I want to emphasize this. They really emphasize this point. Let me quote to you one of them. One of the living maraji has said. After talking about the importance of having strong social relationships in ghurba, when we're in the lands of the non-Muslims, according to the teachings of Ahlul Bayt, he says the following. He says that what I've mentioned right here is particularly important for you, all who are dwelling in lands away from the Muslim lands. Why? Because you are in a situation where just coming together is very difficult, and you are facing a lot of difficulties. And wherever you are going to be a minority. And you are not going to be able to preserve your identity but by means of creating strong believers and strong communities of believers and strong friendships and societies. And by means of these, you will be able to find compassion and unity, and your disunity will fall apart and you will become one and united under one banner. Look at how relevant this piece of advice is for us. Sometimes I get upset when I hear people criticizing our maraji as not being aware of our situation. Have they looked at what they have to say about these things? They're so aware of this. Ayatullah Sistani, he says the following. He says that when he's talking about Silat al-Rahim, having ties with womb relatives, he says that Silat al-Rahim is something which is wajib, and cutting off ties from our womb relatives is one of the major sins. He says that the need for Silat al-Rahim, when one is in a state of ghurba, when one is living in non-Muslim lands like we are, is even more important, where there are very few mu'mineen, and families are living distant from one another. And the relationships that are built on religious principles are falling apart, and the materialism is overcoming them. Look at how much awareness our maraji have about our situation. Subhanallah. I think we need to appreciate their efforts a little bit more and pray for them, and inshallah take more and see how much more guidance we can gain from them. Sallu ala Muhammad wa ali Muhammad. Tonight we've gathered here as part of Ashra Zainabiyah to remember the tragedy that befell the Ahlul Bayt alayhim as-salam. I wish to speak about two individuals who were responsible for leading that caravan as they are going to Kufa. One of them is the Imam of the time, of that time. What is his situation? We're told that when Ubaydullah ibn Ziyad's soldiers came to loot the tents, they found this one young man lying very sick. And when they found out that his name was Ali ibn al-Husayn, they had received orders to kill all the sons of Husayn. But he was so sick that according to some reports, they said that just leave him be, he's going to die on his own after all. There's no need for us to accomplish the deed. This is the state of Imam Zain al-Abidin alayhi salam. At one point, Hazrat Zainab salamullahi alayha sees that his situation is so severe that she goes to him and says, "Oh my nephew, مَا لِي أَرَاكَ تَجُودُ بِنَفْسِكَ. Why is it that I see that you are giving up your own life?" This is the Imam of her time. This is the suffering that he's facing. She has to console him. This is her role. This is the situation of this Imam as he is making his way towards Kufa. Zainab salamullahi alayha has to take this role of leading. She gets to the gate of Kufa. According to history, she hasn't slept for more than 3 days. Imagine the worry and the stress. Imagine the responsibility that is on her shoulders. Yet, when she sees the situation, she realizes that this is her responsibility to speak out. And she addresses the people. Sallallahu alayki ya Zainab, ya binta Ali ibn Abi Talib. Our peace and blessings, we pray to Allah to convey His peace and blessings upon Zainab salamullahi alayha and all the women of the Ahlul Bayt. She turns to the people of Kufa, and according to history, we're told, وَقَدْ أَوْمَأَتْ إِلَى النَّاسِ. And she just turns to the people and she gestures to them. One gesture and the entire city somehow becomes quiet. The bells that were ringing in celebration become quiet, and the breath of people is as if it's held and imprisoned in their chests. Who is speaking here? This is Zainab salamullahi alayha. What is it that she says? Ya ahla Kufa, wa ya ahla al-khatli wal-khadl. O people of Kufa, O the ones who are the people of deception, who left us alone. Atabkun, are you going to cry in this situation? Atabkuna wa tan tahibun. Ay wallahi fa abku kathira wa adhaku qalila. You may cry and weep plentifully, and you may laugh very little. What have you done to us? She gives a speech such that they haven't heard before. One of the enemies reports that when she spoke, I had never seen a woman with such chastity and such nobility speaks such eloquent words. When we heard her words, we remembered the words of Ali ibn Abi Talib alayhi salam. We had never heard such eloquent words since his time.
she speaks, and then it is the time for Imam Zainul Abidin to speak. I have to ask this question, that why is it that there are no Shias to speak on the behalf? Who is there to defend the family of the Prophet? They themselves have to defend themselves. They themselves have to introduce them to themselves to the people. Imam Zainul Abidin cries out, Ayuhan Nas, Man Arafani Faqad Arafani, whoever knows me, knows me. Wa man lam ya'arifni, فَأَنَا عَارِفُهُ بِنَفْسِي. I'm going to introduce myself. أَنَا عَلِي بْنُ الْحُسَيْنُ بْنُ عَلِي بْنِ أَبِي طَالِبِ. I am the one who is the son of the one who was slaughtered at the banks of the Euphrates River. With what eye are you going to look at the Prophet, the Messenger of Allah, on the Day of Judgment when he asks you, قَتَلْتُمْ عِتْرَتِي, you killed my progeny, وَانْتَحَكْتُمْ حُرْمَتِي, you are the ones who violated the sanctity of my family, فَلَسْتُمْ مِنْ أُمَّتِي, were you not among those who considered themselves as part of my ummah? أَلَا لَعْنَةُ اللَّهِ عَلَى الْقَوْمِ الظَّالِمِينَ وَسَيَعْلَمُ الَّذِينَ ظَلَمُوا أَيَّ مُنْقَلِبٍ يَنْقَلِبُونَ.